everybody. I'm Tom, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Tom.
I'm from here. I'm actually from Portsmouth, but I moved back here, moved out to the beach. I've traveled a little bit. And I want to tell you a story about Steve getting me to speak, because that was, I'm walking out of the gym Thursday, and I get a text, and he's like, Tom, man, we don't have a speaker for Friday. And I was like, well, that's your problem, buddy. I got my grandson, you know, that my wife and I told him this at our house. We've been babysitting for a while. That's all another story. My daughter is actually she's at an Oxford house right now in Richmond. But I was like, you know, I'm too damn busy, this and that. And I didn't answer him. Well, all of a sudden, when I get home, my phone starts blowing up. And it's Steve saying, dude, you're the man. Thank you so much. And I'm like, I didn't answer his ass. And sure enough, I looked. And you know those automatic, like, answers that it said, sure. That's what, I swear, I went back and I looked. I said, I didn't answer this. And I was like, what the hell? And I was like, I can't back out now. But I also said, you know, is that odd or is that God? Because I didn't. If I did, it was by mistake, but I'm glad to be here, because any time that I'm asked to do something for AA, you know, I try to step up and do that, you know. And I mean, AA saved my life, okay? And I mean, I'll tell a little bit of my story when I'm in here and try not to bore you with the drunkalogue, but really more of the, what it's done for me and, how it's changed my life. But I grew up out here, and I was thinking before I came in here, about the three legacies, and community, service, and recovery, and not just in the program, but what that's meant in my life. When I was born, and I was actually born in Maryview Hospital, February 25th, 1961, and on my sobriety date is August 3rd, 2007. And I have a sponsor, and he knows I'm his sponsee, and I sponsor some guys. But one of the things that I was always told at an early age was that I was special. And I knew why later, because my mother started hemorrhaging real bad. My uncle was at BMI at that time. My dad was going to Old Dominion. My mother had just graduated from Radford, and I think she was in grad school at William & Mary. They were all first-generation college, so it was really important that I go to college, too. That's a whole nother story. But, at that time, I remember that the story my dad's telling me. He said, your uncle was home, from BMI. He was about to go out. And your mom screams for me in the bathroom. Well, she's just hemorrhaging. She had placenta separated. They rush her to Maryview, and the doctor comes out and tells them that it's touch and go. But my mom would make it, but the baby's probably not going to make it. Lo and behold, I'm here. So I was like the miracle baby, and so treated that way too. Okay, by the family. I felt sorry for my sister, especially with my grandmother. Because, I mean, man, did that woman love me, and I knew it, and I loved her dearly. I really, when my parents started having problems, and they were divorced when I was 8, I wanted to go and live with them, and they probably would have let me. My grandfather and grandmother, I mean, they would have taken me in as an adopted son. And I mean, they knew that I loved them that much, and they loved me, and I grew up with that kind of love in my life. I really did. I was lucky. And I mean, I'm so lucky that my wife today, and she comes from a good family, but I struggle a little more. Didn't have, and not that we were financially in good shape, but it never hurt for anything. My dad was professional. He was involved in a really good salesman. And he owned an insurance agency in Portsmouth. And we never hurt for anything. And when my parents were divorced, my mother remarried an Army officer, and really, really a truly great man. I mean, I grew to love him as much as my father. I wouldn't want to say that around my dad, but he knows how much that man meant to me in my life. And I was really lucky to have two guys in my life like that, that really helped influence me. You know, I didn't do the things that they wanted me to do. Obviously, I wouldn't be here. But, you know, it's one of those deals. You know, we've got alcoholism in our family. My uncle's an alcoholic. Both of my grandfathers were alcoholic. Neither one of my parents were alcoholic. You know? And now it looks like I've got one child that's in recovery. Hopefully. I mean, she's bitching about being up at the Oxford House right now and wants to leave. I'm like, you know, honey, and I told her, she knows better than to say that shit to me, all right? But she's texting my wife, and I said, tell her right now that Dad said, talk to your sponsor. She knows it's no bullshit. She needs to do that. If she wants her son, I don't want to be a parent again. You know, I want to be a grandparent. But anyway, that's where I am right now. Some of what I'm going through right now. But you know, I grew up around here. I'm actually in Craddock. I'm from Craddock. It's where my dad graduated from Craddock High School. My mother graduated from there. I lived there the first 3 years of my life. I don't remember much about it. And then we moved to Western Branch off Woodland or Dock Landing Road. And the story about that, my dad is just about to graduate from Old Dominion. And he tells a story. It's really funny. He was selling Volkswagens and doing student teaching, just about to finish up at Old Dominion. And the football coach at Wilson at that time, who became my wrestling coach later at Churchland, Coach Mooney, he was student teaching under him and told him, you know, Coach, I got a problem. You know, I'm going to get paid whatever it was back then, $1,200, I don't know, a month or something, to be a teacher, if that, probably not even that. Or, you know, right now I'm making like $2,000 a month selling Volkswagens. And Coach looked at me and goes, well, you don't have a choice. You got a family, you're going to be selling cars. And so that, you know, that's, he did. And that's what he started out doing. But the funny story is how he ended up with that house, right? And I shared this with my son. My two sons just bought a home in Kempsville. They went in together and bought a house and their first home. You know, we helped them, but not much financially. We just, you know, kind of steered them in the right direction. But I told them the story. The sales manager, Ozzie Porter, at Victory Sales, at that time, introduced my dad to a guy that was building houses over off of Dock Landing and Woodland Drive. And he said, yeah, I know this guy, Bailey, Rollis Bailey, who's building these houses. And there was a beer joint at that time at the end of Dock Landing called Waltz. And they met him over there. And he was like, oh, you need a house? And he's this young guy, because hell, he was probably 22 at the time. You know, I mean, maybe 20, I don't even think he was 23. Didn't have any money. I mean, he's making decent money for selling cars. But, you know, paying off loans and doing other things. And tell the story, it's like, yeah, we've got a house available, you know, on Rollis Road off of Woodland, $14,500, $89 a month. That was in 1964. And we kept that house, and my sister and I ended up with it. And we just sold it a couple of years ago for like $275,000. So, I mean, you know, and you look at that $14,000, my son almost fell out. He was like, Dad, are you kidding me? You pay more than that for my first car. I said, exactly. You know, and they thought that was a lot of money back then. But, you know, I grew up around there, and especially in the Craddock section of Portsmouth. And, you know, for those of you that live out here, I know you're not going to hold that against me. They do at the beach. I got to be careful about mentioning that. But, you know, it really, and probably still is, you know, it's a little rougher now, but it was just a, you know, hard hat and lunch pail, you know, neighborhoods. You know, the guys worked hard and the women stayed home with the kids and everybody felt safe and it was a good community. And, you know, when they bought the house in Western Branch, same thing. I mean, you know, doors unlocked and everybody knew what everybody else was doing. And if you screwed up, you know, one of the neighbors was going to beat your ass, and nobody was going to say anything. And I wasn't going to say anything because the neighbor was going to come out and say, hey, I gave Tommy a spanking because of this. Oh, well, then I get another one when I get there, you know, and it's just kind of that, one of those deals. But I don't know that I ever, I may have been a shy kid, but I don't ever remember feeling less than, maybe sometimes. But I can tell you this, you know, there was that social anxiety. And, I remember trying beers. My dad would give me a beer, and I hated the taste of it. And, you know, and I grew up around, my uncle, like I said, was an alcoholic. And, you know, he and my dad would go out drinking all the time, and there was a lot of drinking in our household. And, you know, I didn't like it until I actually got some in me. And I'll never forget. And I was probably 14, and we were living in Fort Bragg then. And I'd come back to visit, and under the bridge on Dock Landing Road, I ran into a buddy of mine, and they were drinking Schlitz Tall Boys. And I'm like, yeah, okay. You know, I didn't want to be a wuss, and I'm like, I knew I didn't like the taste of it, but I drank enough. And man, you know, you get that, my lips got numb, my head got light, and I was like, man, we got to go get some more of this shit, you know. And I remember telling him that. I said, so let's go to the store and get some. I'm 14, I couldn't get anybody yet, but we needed to go get some more. I mean, that was how I drank, you know. I mean, and I may have been an alcoholic right out of the gate. I can't answer that. I know progressing to high school, I was involved in sports, but I was also, I partied a lot, and I'd keg parties and things like that. And when I drank, I usually got drunk 9 times out of 10. And I started drinking probably alcoholically then, or binge drinking anyway. I totaled 3 cars my senior year of high school. 2 of them were my fault, 1 wasn't. But still, it doesn't matter. You know, I remember when I wrecked my Grand Torino down at Nag's Head, and I'll never forget this. My senior year, and I went to see my uncle, and he gave me a mug, and he goes, when I'm leaving, he knows we're going down to Nag's Head. It was after I graduated. And my dad, for a graduation present, gave me a case of beer. So we loaded the beer up in the back of my car and drove down there. Well, you know, and I leave my uncle's place. And the last thing he said to me is, just remember, no matter what happens, you're always responsible. I'm like, how the hell is that? That's not true. You know? That's bullshit. Well, me and a friend, and we drank, but we weren't drunk. When I was driving, and I wasn't drunk, but smoking weed and, you know, drinking. And I remember the beach road, and it's not as bad now, but back then, because of the storms, they really had it like, it was leveled like this. So if you get your tire in the middle of the road, you're going to get jerked over to the other side. And it happened a couple of times. We're looking for my buddy's brother's cottage, and all of a sudden, the world turned blue behind me. Shit. So I get pulled over, and the cop asks, he's like, you know, you've been drinking? Yes. You know, how many? I don't know. I mean, I had 2 or 3. I really hadn't. I wasn't, he could tell I wasn't drunk. I could have had 5 or 6, but I wasn't intoxicated. I didn't feel I was intoxicated. He may have thought I was a little. He didn't want to take me in, I could tell. And he was like, look, yeah, I'm looking for my brother's, or my friend's brother's cottage. We're just trying to find a place to go straight there, because if I see you out again, I'm going to arrest you. Well, we get up the next morning, first thing, head down to Hatteras. We were going surfing, Dawn Patrol. And I was, you know, we were smoking, because that's, drugs are a part of my story, but I'll try to eliminate that. But they are a part. And, you know, the last thing the cop said to me was, if somebody was coming the other way, when you were going over the other side, you know, you could have died, and so could they. It would have been a head-on collision. Well, we're heading to Hatteras. We're on the beach road, and I don't remember exactly where we passed, but we had just passed, and I had just passed this fisherman, and this right by this convenience store, and shoot, maybe from here to the back of the room, this Jeep comes all the way over into my lane. Well, then I looked at his face, and he had gone to sleep at the wheel. So I jerked the wheel the other way. He clips the back of my car, sends us into a spin. Well, by the time I got control, I mean, he hit the rear quarter panel, bent my rear axle, and I was still able to drive it. But by the time I got control of the vehicle, the guy was gone. I'm like, that bastard, he's taken off, man. He just hit me and he's taken off. And so I turn around, lumber back up. Well, he had lost control and flipped the Jeep end over end and found median. And this girl, when I get there, he had had this blanket and it just draped over her hand. Well, like half of her finger was missing when we get up, because my friend's like, man, she's in shock. She needs to put a blanket over her. He goes, don't lift the blanket, don't lift the blanket. As soon as we did, and she saw her finger was missing. And you know, I tell that story because the cop that showed up on the scene was the same cop that pulled me over the night before. Mm-hmm. And the guy accused me of running into him. And if it wasn't for me passing the fisherman who pulled the cop aside and said, hey, come here, I'll tell you exactly what happened. I saw it all. And he came, and then the cop came back up to me and he said, you remember what I told you last night? Sir, well, of course, I didn't listen to that shit. I had not many other accidents, but quite a few, and one of them up here. I'll get to that later. But you know, my run-ins with the law typically were when I was under the influence. I can rarely remember any times that wasn't the case, and I wasn't any time that I got in trouble, any time that the law was involved. I was typically drunk or getting that way. And, I growing up around here, when I did graduate and I went to college, I didn't want to go to school. My parents wanted me to because they did. And it was important to them. Like I said, it was rare. And I heard the story of my mother, and, you know, she's still with us, and she's 85. She just turned 85 in August. Doing well. But, you know, she wouldn't have gone to college if it wasn't for my grandfather dying when she was in high school. There's a story on her 40th birthday. I don't know, I was 18 or 19. And she just gets choked up. And I had never really heard her talk about my grandfather that much. But what he did, because my mom and my uncle, and one of the payoffs of the program, and I was sharing this with Steve, so I had dinner with my youngest son. If I was still drinking, he wouldn't want to be around me, you know. And he works for us now, and you know, he wants to be around me, and I want to be around him. But you know, one of the things that I don't even forget what I was talking about now. But anyway, I lost my train of thought about the other thing. It doesn't matter. Oh yeah, okay. Yeah. My grandfather, my mom, thank you. But she broke down in tears. And I'd seen my mom choked up a few times. She's a tough lady. And she just starts, just weeping. Because her father came to her, and like I said, my uncle was a math whiz. He graduated with an engineering degree from BMI. He always smart. And both of them, my mom was really smart. And my grandfather went to them. I guess my mom was probably in 10th grade at that time. And she's like, look, I know that you're smart and you deserve to go to college, but I can only afford to send one of you to college, and it's gonna be your brother. And if it wasn't for the fact of him passing away, I think he died at her junior year in high school. And she was able to get scholarships and some grants because she was that smart, and straight A's at Wilson, and you know, really, I mean, just she's smart as shit. I mean, you know, she got her master's degree in 5 years and was able to do it while she was pregnant with me, driving back and forth from Portsmouth. I mean, she went to Radford back when it was an all-girls school, but, you know, that's where she got her four-year degree. But then, you know, driving and got her master's degree at William & Mary while she was pregnant with me, driving back and forth from Portsmouth to Williamsburg. And so, I mean, I say that because I'm proud of my parents, and it's a shame the things that we put our loved ones through when we're doing the things we're doing. And I put them through hell. I really did. Totaling cars, going out and not knowing if I'm going to make it back. Hell, my father, in an insurance business, he told me this later, and I hadn't sobered up. I think he said, he told me, after I was about 23 or 24, he said, son, I saw the way you were behaving when you were 16, 17 years old. He took out like a $200,000 life insurance policy on me. He goes, I gave you about a 50-50 chance of making it home, you know, every time you went out. And he said, I figured if you made it to 23, you might make it. But I wasn't sure between that and that. And, I had to deal with that. But the bad part about that is I've got three kids, and it had to be the girl, you know, and that's tough, man. That is tough, and it's tough to do tough love with a 15-year-old that's running down to the ocean front and looking like she's 19 or 20, you know, and calling for a ride home, and I start dealing with this, and really have to pull the tough love thing. It's like, you don't have permission to go down there, and I'm not coming to pick you up. That was one of the hardest things that I've ever done, because then on my mind, I'm like, oh, crap, man. You know, she's going to be kidnapped and all that. And the person that helped me get through that, she was like, did you give her permission to go down there? No, I didn't. Well, then she can find her way back. And this woman is an addictionologist. She deals with addicts. And hell, I think Steven gave me your number, you know, years ago. But I still talk to her today because I need to still. She goes, Tom, you're one of my success stories. And so when I started talking to this lady, not only was I dealing with an addict daughter, but, you know, we were struggling in business. And she mentions to me, she goes, you were like a tight piano wire that was about to snap. Now, I was sober, but I was still, you're going through things even in sobriety. And sometimes it's damn hard. I mean, I don't care who you are, but you won't have to drink over it, man. And I can go through. I mean, one of the last times that I stopped, when I stopped drinking for the first time, we were living in that house, my wife and I. And I met her. Y'all can appreciate it. I'll share this. I was her FedEx guy, and I was going to George Mason. I worked for FedEx, and I was a FedEx driver, and that's how I met her. She had, you know, was good-looking blonde on the desk, and I was like, well, I had a girlfriend at the time, but the girl that she worked with, that was funny. Well, you know, one day, they called me back there like 3 or 4 times, and I told them, I was like, you know, the cutoff is like 3 or 4 o'clock, whatever you have coming out, just wait until 4, just call me once and I'll come by. And I hear this lady laughing in the other room, and she's probably my age now. And she's just like, yeah, that cute FedEx guy. Not that I think I'm cute. I think my wife must have thought that back then, or we wouldn't be together. But, you know, we ended up seeing each other, you know, running around and seeing each other out. When it's even though Northern Virginia is a big place, you know, the places where younger people hang out, there's not a lot of them. And we ended up just seeing each other, and one thing led to another. And, you know, I mean, it was good for a while. It really was. I mean, and one of the things I remember saying to her early on, I said, you know, I might be an alcoholic. And I was always the last one around the keg at fraternity parties. And I multiple DUIs, total cars. And I told her, I said, you know, I think I might have a drinking problem. I might be an alcoholic. And she was like, no, you just like to have fun. And that's all I needed to hear, right? And so it's just off to the races for another year until we got married and we were living out in New Mexico, and I'd taken a sales job with FedEx. And this is that alcoholic thing kicking in, right? Well, I think I'm not good enough. And even though I'm doing really well, I'm working my ass off, and we're actually doing pretty good. I mean, my wife's really smart. She got a job at Sandia National Labs, and Albuquerque. I'm working for FedEx, double income, no kids. We were doing pretty well. And even in my second year out there, I got the top sales in the Western region. Well, they made a mistake though to give out the awards. They decided to have the sales rally in Las Vegas. And I say a mistake because the same day I got the award, I think I drank a whole bottle of Wild Turkey, and this was late. That wasn't when I accepted the award, but it was later that night, right? And I really didn't like my boss's boss because I thought she should have gotten his job because I thought she was a lot better. And I really didn't. I didn't like the guy. For whatever reason, I didn't like him. And nothing against John, I just didn't like his ass. And not that he deserved it either, but I evidently just totally insulted him up and down. I mean, I have vague memories of the things I was saying to him. And this is the inappropriate shit that comes out, right? When we're drinking because of all the crap that we've stuffed down and not knowing how to release it, right? Because I know now, I mean, things just don't bother me. And I don't stuff them down because I can either pick up the phone, call one of you guys. Y'all understand. Nobody else understands us like other alcoholics. Nobody does. Or, I just have different ways of doing it. I can meditate. I can pray. I can say the serenity prayer and no matter how many times until it works. Whatever I have to do. But I didn't have that back then, and I didn't know what the hell to do. So I would either drink over the feelings to hide any emotion. And when I got drunk, and typically in a blackout, I would turn into, and they even called me this when I was at Mason in my fraternity, my nickname was Gremlin because, I was like a real mild and mannered guy normally, but when I drank, I turned into, well, not every time, but a lot of times I turned into a jackass and would just act like an ass to people. And I didn't know why I was pissed. And I have one guy come up and goes, "Man, why were you so pissed at me last night?" I was. I don't know. Have no idea. I don't. And that's how alcohol affected me. Loved it, loved the feeling. And, just like my buddy Tuffy said, if you didn't have fun, you got screwed. Because I had plenty of fun. And that's okay. But until the fun was over and it became not only a crutch, but something I couldn't live without. And when my wife and I moved back here, 95, she'd had about enough. I mean, it had come to a point. I mean, I'd say I would stop, but I couldn't. I mean, I would maybe for a week or, at the most. I don't even know if I'd get a week without drinking. And we moved back here. And my dad and I were drinking buddies. I mean, he liked drinking with me. I liked drinking with him. I mean, I think at some point, I reminded him of my uncle, and he used to say that shit. He goes, "You act just like your uncle when he'd get drunk." And he'd have to get him out of bar fights. I didn't like the fight because I'm a small guy, and I'd usually get my ass kicked. But I still got plenty of bruises because I would stand up to guys that I had no reason to even mess with or even try to do it. Just because I'm stupid. Especially when I'm drinking. I don't do that shit today. Plus, I like my life. I try to avoid those things. And it's not that hard today. I recall one, and this is so funny. I'm taking my daughter to her first treatment. She's been to five. And we're going up to Edge Hill. One of her buddies is with her. And this girl now has 3 or 4 years sober. And she just had a little baby, and I'm good friends with her dad. And we used to share stories because, you know, his daughter and my daughter were just, you know, two peas in a pod. And, you know, I don't know, this was probably 5-6 years, I don't know how many years ago. I get pulled over in Richmond. I do a illegal U-turn. I'm going to get them food because they're hungry. And we get pulled over, and I just start talking to the cop, you know, just shooting the shit with him. I tell him, I'm not from around here. I'm from the beach. We're good. I'm taking my daughter up to Winchester. I just did a U-turn to go get some food. Whatever I said. I mean, whatever it was the truth. And, you know, he comes back. He gives me his card. He goes, man, you're ever around, you need anything, here's my card, Sheriff. You know, have a nice night, Mr. Perry. And the girls, and they're freaking out. I didn't know that. No, because they're drug addicts. And what, you know, if you're doing drugs and you get pulled over, are you freaking out? Hell yeah, you're freaking out. I used to freak out anytime I'd see lights behind me when I was drinking. And when we pull away, they were just like, Dad, how did you do that? I said, how did I do what? You just talked to that cop and nothing happened. I was like, holy shit, are you kidding me? Yeah, well, you know what? If you treat people a certain way, wow, man, you know? Because I forgot, I used to be the same way. I used to feel the same way. And I don't care. I mean, I see some lights behind me, you know, whatever. I mean, that's a gift, guys. Because, I mean, I know for this alcoholic it is. I don't know about you guys. But I used to drink and drive a lot. I drank and drove so much. I mean, I had 60 UIs, but I should have had 106, probably more than that. But you know, one of the things, and this is another payoff of the program. And Steve and I met. We were DCMs, and after that, I became the. And this is the service part, okay? And I'm kind of jumping around. I apologize about that. But this is important because part of the DUI stories and part of the fact of sobering up, you know, I was the cooperation with the professional group for the VAC. And I got this email. And, you know, I thought it was from an HR person. Just wanted to learn because we got emails from different people all over the state, and just wanted to know about, you know, AA and how, you know, what we could send them, what's it all about. We got people that need help, and all it said was Roxy. It didn't have anything else and her name and number. And so I sent her an email. She goes, could you please call me? And I said, yeah, sure, no problem. And I called her and she was like, yeah, this is Roxy Holder. She goes, I'm Circuit Court Judge in Portsmouth. And I'm just like, holy shit. Okay, really, Judge Holder? It was nice talking to you. She goes, yeah, could you come down and meet with me? And then I take a deep breath. I'm like, okay, yeah, okay, I'll come down and meet with you. And I'm like, and I get in there, and that's the first time I've ever not seen a judge on the side of the bench. I'm actually in her, you know, in her office. And as we start talking, you know, it dawned on me, and it was very apparent that her life was touched by alcoholism. There's somebody in her family, and it came, her son and her father were both alcoholics. And the thing that she said to me, she said, you know, Tom, she said, I don't want to send any drunks to jail. She goes, but if you come into my court for the third time, you're going to be charged with a felony and you're going to prison. And I don't have a choice. I've got to do that. And she's like, if you can help me to help anybody, you know. And so we put pamphlets up in there. And of course, we're sitting there. And then she goes, well, have you ever had a DUI? And I'm like, crap. And I said, yes, ma'am. And more than one? Yes. How many have you had? It was just like, you know, telling questions that I didn't want to answer. And I'm just like, six. Well, she started cracking up. I thought she was going to fall out of her chair. Mm-hmm. And she goes, not anymore. And I said, I know that. And we ended up becoming friends. And she actually helped me get my daughter into Scared Straight. And But those things would not happen if it was not for AA. I wouldn't be able to tell you that story. I should be dead. I should be dead or in jail. And I spent time in jail. I spent time in prison. You know, I'm not going to bore you with some of that, but it was because of my prison time was indirectly because of my behavior while under the influence and the stuff that I was doing with customers. Because basically what it was is that the U.S. government didn't appreciate my entertainment practices with some of their employees. And so I ended up spending some time in federal prison. But, you know, I don't have those stories today. And I take that time because I share that because the judge that sentenced me did not have to do that. I could have gotten probation. But instead I've got 8 months. And then 3 years probation and another 6 months of home confinement. But I also look at that as my treatment because I saw where I could have been. You know, and if it was, I don't think it was an accident that before I went to the federal camp in Lewisburg, that I actually was in the USP for 6 weeks under lock and key before they could find a space for me. And now they had me separated, and us, because it was more than just me, separated from the animals that were in there. And I say that literally because from where we were at the locked up area, we could see out in the yard. And every morning, man, they would bring these guys out and leg chains with their handcuffs behind their back, and they put them in these, and they looked like oversized dog cages. And those were the dudes that were in the hole at the USP. And that was their exercise time, walking back and forth in a dog cage. And I was just like, you know, if I ever get out of here, my ass is not coming back. And I, you know, knock on wood, I haven't. And y'all, this is really funny because I'm there. My kids are young men. And second time that I get a visitation, I'm working on a farm, so I got a good tan. This is a summertime. I look really good. I thought I did. And I think my family did. And of course, my wife was like, Jesus, I'm at home taking care of the kids, and you've got this beautiful tan. And I said, yeah, but I'm locked up, honey. I mean, it's not like I'm having fun out there. Try and have as much fun as you can. I tell this story because when the youngest son that I had dinner with tonight and my daughter, who was the middle child, when they were leaving, we had a visit. One of them grabbed a hold of my left leg, the other one grabbed a hold of my right, and they just held on and they wouldn't let go. I'd never been away from them before. And they were both crying and just, daddy, daddy, no, I want to stay in it. And I turned back around and I looked at this guy, and here's another dude in prison. There's a tear rolling down his face, watching what was going on with me. And, you know, I had so many, there's just so many stories. There are angels, man, in my life, you know? There are. And here's the funny thing, right? And I'm not trying to separate myself from those guys because I belong there. I deserve to go. I say that now. And I can tell you that when I went in, the sponsor that I had at that time, and because I sobered up in 2005, but I had a couple of slips, and that's when I signed the plea agreement and went in. But I remember my sponsor at that time, he said, you need to pray for that judge. And I said, oh, I'll pray for him, all right. And I prayed that he died every night. I said, I want, because he had open heart surgery before. I wasn't going to have it. I said, that rotten SOB, I hope he dies, in his sleep. I don't give a shit about it. I don't know how many times I prayed like that about him. I mean, it was a while. And then all of a sudden, I couldn't do that anymore. This is why I was locked up, you know? And I don't know how it changed or why it changed, but it did. And it was just something that came over me because I couldn't keep saying negative prayers about somebody. And I got to the point where, you know, I prayed for every good thing in that man's life that I prayed for myself and my family to happen to him. Because I'd be damned if I'd want to sit in judgment of anybody. I wouldn't want that pressure. You know, even though I hated him at the time and sensed me and took me away from my family, you know, I broke the law. I did wrong. And you know, he was doing his job. And so, I mean, those are the things, again, in the program. And, you know, the unity. And to me, I was already getting that in the program by just doing that. And I didn't go to any AA meetings when I was in there. We talked about sobriety and how important it was to some guys. But, you know, coming out, I mean, it was a struggle. It was not only a struggle financially and with the family, but, you know, also with me. And I had two slips and got drunk. I got to come home after a halfway house and putting up Christmas lights, and I got drunk. And, you know, told my sponsor about it. Or no, I don't think I did. Nope, I didn't. That was a story I did not. And this was 2006, all right? So, and the summer of 2007, 2006, trying to think. I remember, oh yeah, because this was, and then I let it go to 2008. I did actually pick up a damn chip and didn't say anything to anybody that September, because I had sobered in September. And then I'm driving, and in 2007, and my wife had been given some Xanax when I was in, you know, I was in jail to help her out. And so we're down in Kiowa, and I'm like, well, let me try one of those damn things, you know. So I don't know if I took one or two. And then, you know, I used to drink what I call these island drinks, right? And I would put some Red Bull and, you know, cranberry and splash of Sprite, some limes. That was my drink. Well, you know, after a couple of Xanaxes, hell, man, I thought some vodka in here would be really a good idea too. And so that's what I did. I had two big tumblers of that shit. And to this day, I do not know why I did this. Everybody is down at the beach. I came up and I did. I had two big drinks, and I was about to make a third one and go down there. Or hell, I probably would have finished the half gallon, or it was a half of a half gallon. It would have been gone. And for whatever reason, I went into the bedroom, laid down, and I fell asleep for like 2.5 hours, 3 hours. Nobody knew that I had had anything to drink, except for me and God. And I went for another year and didn't say anything. And this was in 2008. And I called my sponsor, and we were working on the ninth step. And I'm like, Chris, I gotta come clean, buddy. I said, you know, I drank in August 2000, the last year, on August 3rd. And he said, Tom, and I told him the whole thing. And he said, and I was going to the Breakfast Club. I was heading there. And he said, you don't need to pick up a white chip because it's been a year since you drank. He said, but you need to go in and tell everybody in that meeting exactly what you just told me. I was like, anything but that. I didn't want to do that. But I did it because my sponsor asked me to do it, and because I'd come clean with some bullshit that I was hiding. And I went in, and, you know, it was scary, man. I didn't want to come clean to you guys. Not that it really matters, because I would do whatever today. It doesn't bother me, but then it did. What are you going to think of me? You're such a loser. You can't stay sober. Well, a lot of people can't stay sober. And one of the things that Chris said to me, my sponsor, he said, Tom, it is the most natural thing in the world for an alcoholic to drink. And that helped me. I'd never heard that before. You know, and I said, okay. So I went in, and I told him. And holy shit, the response I got. You know, I'm telling and coming clean with what I had done and hiding it. And you know, all of a sudden, I'm shining a light on that. And the one person I remember, this old guy, Carl from New York, he's like, Tom, do you realize what you've just done?
He goes, you've opened up the sunlight of the Spirit, not only on yourself, but everybody in this room is better. I was like, all right, don't go too far because I do have an ego, okay? But no, man, I needed to hear that.
Because the lies are what'll kill us, man. They will. They'll take us down. And, today I don't have to worry about that. How much time do I have? Am I done? I don't want to bore you guys. I could go on for another hour. I'm not going to do that, though.
10 minutes.
All right. I won't go that long. But, you know, one of the things that, and just the unity, and I get back to the program and what it's done for me, and service work has saved my life. I mean, I early on, for whatever reason, when I started going, and my home group is the Thursday night men's group down at the oceanfront, has been for years. Right? I mean, first time I went there was probably close to 20 years ago. But at least at least 16 years, because I just picked up a 16-year medallion. But one of the things that I was talking about was that the service and how important it is. I'm standing there and I'm not doing anything. I'm just trying to, you know, get back in the big bed, not be a total jackass and try and get my company back to where we're actually making money, not losing money. And my sponsor is standing here. I'm standing there and his other sponsor is standing on the other side. Well, Stuart had some other commitment on Thursday and he was making coffee. And so they asked for a volunteer to make coffee. I wasn't gonna volunteer shit. You know, I didn't want to make coffee for you jackasses. I didn't. I had better things to do. I had other more important things that I needed to do with my time than to spend it having to come in an hour or two early to set up for a meeting. And so this is going through my mind, okay? This is my brain, you know, the committee in Tom's head telling me the things that I shouldn't do or should do. And my sponsor just grabbed my arm and threw it up. I'm like, you jackass, you know? Okay, fine. The last thing I wanted to do was make coffee for those guys. And that's a year commitment. They gave me the keys to the place. I had to set up the meeting, and because you got to break down the tables, set up the meeting every night. At the end of that year, they had to pry those keys out of my hand. I didn't want to give it up. You know, the people that I'd met, the things I was doing, the difference that it had made in my life and the other people in my life. And that set me on a course of service work. Came a GSR. DCM, worked at, you know, I mean, I look back, I think it was 9 years. I mean, I was nothing but doing service, and it got to a point where my wife was like, are you going to do something else? You know, you can't do it, because, you know, when you do something with the state, I mean, you're away at least four weekends a year, right? She's like, haven't you done enough? I said, am I a better person now? You know, do you like me better now, or do you like me better before? All right. See, he's going to pull the hook on me. I told you I could stay up here and talk. All right, I'll wrap it up. But I will share this, though, with my wife, and I love her dearly. And one of the payoffs of the program, and I think I shared this with Steve, is my grandson, even though my daughter's in treatment, right? And I don't know if anybody's old enough to know who the Little Feet is. Anybody know the band Little Feet? Okay, see, all right. Anyway, they played at the Warner Theater last week in D.C. And for my wife's birthday, which is next week, we got tickets. We had fourth row. We took my grandson with us, and my nephews stayed with him. Okay, while we went to the show. While we're there, all I'm thinking about is my grandson. It's like, this is great. These guys are super. They're playing just like they did 30 years ago, the last time I saw them. But I also got my grandson in the back of my mind, like, really, I could have as much fun playing with him and being with him, which is the same thing I thought about tonight when he first asked me to speak. Okay? Well, and this is the payoffs, guys. We had a great time, and the show was fantastic. Get home. And it's 11:30, and my grandson's still up. Now, he's only 17 months old. But we told my nephew, yeah, fine, let him stay up if you don't want to go to bed. Don't worry about it. And my sister-in-law standing behind me as we walked in, and she was like, he's going to cry when he sees you guys. We got all excited, and that's the first thing he did. Then he just starts bawling. It's like, damn, you left me with these guys. I thought you were never coming back. Well, I pick him up. He kissed me 3 times and then wrapped his little arms around my neck. Now, if that's not a payoff for being sober and working the program, I'll kiss your ass. I mean, that is the things that happen because of sobriety, guys. You know, I get to enjoy my grandson. If I was still drinking and drugging, they wouldn't want me around him. And now not only does my daughter want me around him, and that's a whole another story, is that because of his father, we have shared custody right now. And the state wants us to, or the city wants us to take care of him. So anyway, I appreciate it. Thank you, Steve, for asking me to come out, even though I didn't agree to it. I'm glad I came out here. And that's all I got. Guys. Thanks.
Thank you, Tom.
Yes, sir.